Wednesday, June 25th. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Today, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. The court is set to close out a historic and divisive term with rulings on birthright citizenship, online speech, and voting rights still pending. But they've already made a number of rulings on everything from bans on gender-affirming care to limits on environmental protections and immigrant rights. And the court's conservative supermajority has reshaped key legal norms. But it's not just the decisions, it's the process that people are talking about, it's the justices that folks are talking about. And so we have two great guests coming on the show to help us walk through this latest term and the impact that President Donald Trump has made on the court in the sense that he has challenged the Constitution, he has challenged the norms of an executive, and has put the court under scrutiny as well. And so we'll be talking about that. And we also want to hear from you because we'd love to get your take on this year's court term. What U.S. Supreme Court cases are you paying most attention to? Which ones do you think will be the most consequential? And do you have faith in the high court? Those are our questions. Feel free to weigh in on any of those. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comments in the live chat.
Two great guests, as you mentioned, one of whom's last name is Wolf. I'm into that.
Yeah.
You know I love my wolves.
You love the wolves.
And also Nina Totenberg.
Big deal.
Legendary NPR legal affairs correspondent. Excited to hear from both of them. Again, that number, 888-477-9499. The email, studio2@whyy.org. We're talking about judges today and judgment. Can I get your judgment on something real quick, Jerry?
Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm going to read you four names. I just want you to pick one for whatever reason you want to pick. I don't care about the criteria. Okay.
Okay.
VJ Edgecombe, Con Knipple, Ace Bailey, and Trey Johnson. Pick one of those four.
Ace Bailey.
Okay, that's who the Sixers will select tonight with the number three overall pick and the first. Why'd you pick Ace Bailey?
Well, I like the name Ace.
Ace.
Also, it's the third name you mentioned, and you know that's my favorite number, so go ahead.
All right, Ace Bailey, that's the pick, folks. You don't even need to watch the draft tonight. The Sixers will select Ace Bailey. Now a trio, speaking of three, a trio of local news stories. And let's stay on this judiciary theme. At this hour, senators down in Washington are questioning a Trump nominee to the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals. That's a very big court, and it's located right down the street from us here in Old City, Philadelphia. Any nomination for a position like this would be noteworthy, but there's a lot of attention on this particular nominee. His name is Emil Bove. He's a former federal prosecutor who has become a major Trump ally, even defended the president in court on several occasions. He now works for the Justice Department. But here's where the controversy around Bove really heats up. Mm-hmm. A whistleblower alleges that Bove suggested the Trump administration ignore court orders in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador and since returned. And this whistleblower says Bove was basically giving the advice, ignore what the courts say. That would be a pretty stunning position to take for someone who then wants to be on the Court of Appeals. Bove also involved in the DOJ's decision to drop corruption charges against NYC Mayor Eric Adams. So that's also a point of contention. Big hearing going on today in Washington.
Yeah, and to be clear, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche has called the allegations by that whistleblower utterly false. But I will say that, you know, these are ethical issues. Like, it's not necessarily illegal to have these types of discussions about defying court orders, but it is unethical. And people have been disbarred from the practice of law for doing these types of things. And if you are disbarred, you can't be a prosecutor, you can't be a judge.
Yeah.
And so it does raise a lot of questions. And actually, the bar is higher for judges, right? You can't just not be unethical, but you can't have even the appearance of impropriety, right?
Yeah.
Because people need to believe that you are unbiased. So I think even his close connections with the Trump administration would give a lot of people pause on both sides of the aisle. So I wonder, you know, as he goes through his confirmation hearings, whether there will be a number of Republicans that may decide to not give him the okay, just given those connections and given some of the ethical questions that have been raised.
Yeah, it'll be a critical test of the Trump administration's influence. Story number two, Chair.
Yeah. If you have driven up or down Spring Garden Street to jump on Columbus Boulevard, you've probably noticed dozens, if not scores, of people sort of standing around or sitting on a brick wall there waiting with luggage. Well, that is the bus terminal that folks have been using to get on the Greyhound and the Peter Pan bus and the Mega bus and all that. Why? Well, because despite the fact that it's been nearly 2 years, Philadelphia buses still do not have a permanent terminal for pickup or drop off. The Philadelphia Inquirer has documented the saga over the past couple years, and in a recent article, they did a whole timeline there. And it was June of 2023 when the Greyhound bus terminal on Filbert Street was shut down. And since then, the location for bus pickup and drop off has sort of moved around. Remember, it was at 6th and Market, and everybody.
Yeah, that stunk.
That was horrible.
Well, it was bad for us specifically because we work here, but yeah.
Yeah, but there was no bathroom, no place.
But it was also overall bad for sure.
Sit.
Yeah.
And since then, it's kind of moved to Northern Liberties and up and down Spring Garden, currently where it sits. They've made some improvements, and there have been a number of proposals, but none have stuck. And we're at this impasse where there is no permanent terminal for bus pickup, and folks are just kind of out there despite the heat.
Yeah.
And they have installed bathrooms and things, but still, it just sort of looks bad, and it seems unsafe to kind of just be out there on Spring Garden Street and not have an actual structure of protection.
It's also just crazy. For 2 years,
Philadelphia,
one of the biggest cities in the country, just hasn't had a bus terminal. And I guess the question is, who's motivated to fix this?
Mm-hmm.
Is the city motivated to fix this because it looks bad? Mm-hmm. Are the companies motivated to fix this? Well, I mean, they can pick people up at the curb and not pay to like maintain a facility. Maybe they just go that direction. I guess the motivation for them would be, well, maybe we'll have more customers if they're more comfortable waiting for the bus. But I don't know the economics of what they're dealing with. Maybe they really have no incentive.
Yeah.
Someone's got to find the incentive here because it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah. And during a May city council hearing, the CEO of Peter Pan bus company basically said that they would buy the Roundhouse, which is in Old City, right across the street from WHYY, and that they would turn that into a bus terminal and then lease it back to the city. So far, there hasn't been any movement on that. That was just said in May. We'll see if that happens, but that's the latest proposal. And right now, folks are still sitting on Spring Garden Street.
Woo-woo. It's, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. Right now, it's like Neverland.
Mm-hmm.
Third story.
Yep.
Center City Sips. Do you know about it?
I've heard about it. Been to Sips. Like Sips.
You like Sips?
I used to like Sips.
You used to like Sips? Why did you like Sips?
Because the drinks were cheap and it was a reason to kind of hang out in Center City on a Wednesday night.
So Center City Sips is a longstanding neighborhood-wide happy hour downtown that takes place on Wednesdays during the summer. Over 90 bars participate. Lots of youths like to attend it. They hop around from bar to bar. It's kind of become a cultural phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Center City Sips. The question now is, has it also become a nuisance? The Inquirer reports that three bars have pulled out of the program this summer. They say the event is drawing these massive crowds just kind of mill around outside the bars and prevent people from actually going to the bars, which is the opposite of what it's supposed to do. Sips is a very big topic on social media, again, among the youths. And there are lots of viral videos about it and consequently some really big crowds gathering in Center City for this weekly happy hour called Center City Sips. So Sips at an impasse, Cherry. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Talk about big stories. This is huge.
I'm going to say this. I am no longer a youth. Youth, one of the youths you just referred to, because a lot of us are opting
out.
You're
a youth in your heart.
I am. But seeing those crowds, and there was a viral video of just the swarm of people that took over Samson Street. And, Samson Street.
Gotta get that right.
The question is it because of TikTok? And just one post can draw hundreds of people and they can clog up. And they were actually selling liquor out their trunks. They weren't even going into the bars.
It was bootleg Sips.
Yeah, they were
Center City Sips and bootleg Sips. Can I just say something real quick before we go to break? I'm not a Sips person. I would rather go to the dentist every Wednesday than go to Center City Sips. I don't like the big crowds. I don't like the scene, the vibe. That said, I want to defend SIPs because we need more people at the bars.
Yeah.
That bring people together in urban spaces for positive reasons. Do not let SIPs die in a hail of TikTok posts. We have to save SIPs. Even though I don't like SIPs, we got
to
save
SIPs. And
SIPs
used to be really low-key and great. Maybe they can get back to that. We'll see what happens.
Yes, bring back low-key SIPs. LKS.
Yes, low-key SIPs.
Bring back low-key, BBLKS.
And on the other side of this break, we're talking the U.S. Supreme Court. What cases are you paying the most attention to? Call us 888.
SIPs versus Philadelphia. That's my case.
We'll see you on the side of this break.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York. That was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. 2 miles separate the White House and the U.S. Supreme Court. And right now, they may be the two most important miles in American democracy. Donald Trump started his term with a flurry of executive actions that tested the limits of the presidency. As the Supreme Court winds down its term, we wait to see if the High Court will rein him in.
That is in addition to big cases on trans health care, religious freedom, and voting rights, some of which have been decided, other of which are still outstanding. Here to help us make sense of this Supreme Court term so far is Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Nina, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us here in studio is Tobias Wolf, Jefferson B. Fordham professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Carey Law School. Tobias, great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And our listeners at home and out and about, I want to remind you that you can join the conversation. Our questions of the day are this. What U.S. Supreme Court cases are you paying most attention to? Which ones do you think will be the most consequential? And do you have faith in the High Court? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your comments in the live chat. And so I just wanted to sort of set the scene with both of you, Nina and Tobias. I mean, both of you watched the court for many years, and I want to just kind of do a scene setter. What makes this moment with the court a little bit different? And is that because of Donald Trump? And Nina, we'll start with you, and then Tobias will have you weigh in.
Everything is because of Donald Trump to some extent. I mean, the Supreme Court has pushed back against presidents, Democratic and Republican, but the court is now populated by a majority of justices, a supermajority of justices, who really believe in strong executive power, and they all come from the executive branch, largely with the exception of Justice Barrett. All the rest of the members of the Supreme Court majority worked in Republican administrations, had clashes with, to one extent or another, with Democrats on the Hill, and felt that their bosses, writ large, the presidents, were frustrated by actions of the, by the Democrats and by the Supreme Court as well. And they now have the power to make sure that doesn't happen again, and to undo some of the things the court has done in the past. And that is the situation we find ourselves in. I don't mean to suggest that they're wrong or that this is a partisan effort by the members of the court, but it is a confluence between a very, let's put this mildly, unusual president of the United States, unlike a president I've seen in my many decades of covering Washington, and a court that is pretty bent on tearing up some of the previous things that the Supreme Court has done in previous decades.
Yeah. And Tobias, you would love to you for you to weigh in.
Sure. You know, part of what we're seeing, I think, is at the Supreme Court level is a continuation of some movement that the conservative majority has been advancing for some years now, of, as Nina says, of greater deference to executive authority, the ability of presidents to remove executive appointees without restraint by Congress, for example, which is an issue that has been debated on the court and among constitutional scholars for a long time, and a conservative majority in the court has been giving presidents greater and greater power to do that. And, you know, trends away from recognizing, I mean, obviously the overruling of Roe versus Wade and some trends away from recognizing individual rights and liberties. Those trends have been happening for a long time. They're compounded right now by the current occupant of the Oval Office, who is unrestrained would be a polite way of saying it, mm-hmm. right? In testing the boundaries of his power in office mm-hmm. and frankly of testing the boundaries of the rule of law. And so the lower federal courts are being put in the position over and over and over again of mm-hmm. having to do their best to apply existing Supreme Court precedent, often to restrain actions that he's taking, which are clearly improper or at least illegal under current doctrine. And then initial indications that the Supreme Court is giving us of directions that they might be interested in pushing their own precedents. For mm-hmm. example, on this issue of firing or removing executive appointees, and we can talk more about some of the details, questions that have come up in front of the Supreme Court, not yet as fully briefed and argued cases, but on what's often referred to as the shadow docket,
yeah.
which let me just give a shout out to Professor Steve Vladek, who's the leading authority on these questions, I think it's fair to say, among yeah. law professors. And the court is in many ways giving Mr. Trump a certain amount of leeway mm-hmm. in and placing limits on what the lower federal courts have been doing.
Yeah. And so we want to jump right in. And thank you for sort of setting the scene for this court mm-hmm. and under this president right now. And so we want to jump right into the cases that are still pending. And a big one, I think, is the birthright citizenship case that really isn't about birthright citizenship. And so, Nina, I'd love for you to kind of weigh in, kind of explain what that case is really about and why it could have a ripple effect on the many challenges that President Trump has brought and that are currently before the court.
Well, I typically do pre-writes of the possible outcomes in cases. Mm-hmm. And in this one, I've written 6 pre-writes and I have no confidence that I still have everything that the court might do. So what happened here is that Donald Trump for years and years and years has embraced what I think is acknowledged as a somewhat fringe theory that the Constitution, which guarantees automatic citizenship to any baby born in the United States, that he believes that the Constitution doesn't say what it says, mm-hmm. and that therefore he has issued an executive order that would deny automatic citizenship for any baby born in the United States to parents who are illegally here or to parents who are legally here but on a temporary basis, for example, if they have a work visa, even no matter how long they've been here. So I think the Solicitor General's office, the 3 district court judges of Democrats and Republicans swiftly struck this down as unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And a Reagan appointee called it blatantly unconstitutional. And so it gets appealed up to the Supreme Court. But the administration, I think, realistically understands that it's not going to win on the question of birthright citizenship. After all, it's been Supreme Court precedent, not only what the words in the Constitution, but it's been Supreme Court precedent for 127 years, yes. a decision that has been undisturbed. So I think they figured out in the Solicitor General's office they were likely to lose on birthright citizenship. So instead, they didn't ask the court to review those lower court orders. Instead, what they asked the Supreme Court to do was to say that those judges lacked the power to issue nationwide injunctions barring enforcement of the executive order, which is which would, of course, yes, effectively leave the president's
yes,
executive order in place. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are. This is not the question of birthright citizen was not briefed or argued in the Supreme Court. That's not to say that the court couldn't just say, and by the way, we think this is entirely, the executive order is unconstitutional. But I don't know how they would do that. But
yeah,
this is the Supreme Court. Yeah. It can do what it wants. I've got six variables. I don't know how my colleague over there, who knows a lot more about constitutional law than I do, if he's got 10 variables.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Yeah, 10 variables, 12, 100, Tobias?
let's just start with, I'm going to coin the term and credit it to Nina Totenberg, the and by the way move, the and by the way swerve by the Supreme Court, because this court has been doing a whole lot of and by the ways.
Yeah.
And they have been speaking directly or indirectly to the merits of questions in orders and opinions where they have no business doing so. And so I wouldn't. Why? It's a very good question. Why? It's a way of moving the law and signaling to lower federal courts without actually having to go through the work and the internal politics on the court of rendering a major precedent on the question, right? And so I don't think it's impossible in the birthright citizenship case that the court will do an and by the way and reference Wong Kim Ark, this earlier decision from the late 19th century, and say that's still good law, right?
Yeah.
But Nina's right that this is a case about the power of federal courts to issue or remedial orders. They're often called nationwide injunctions. There's also a term, universal injunctions, because the issue isn't so much the nationwide scope, but it's that it's an injunction that applies to the benefit of lots of people who are not actually parties before the court, right? And so these cases were cases brought by individuals or by states in some cases.
And organizations.
But they seek to benefit everybody who would be targeted by this executive order.
And Tobias, the issue with this particular case is that, you know, if it would, it would slow down the idea or the efforts of folks to get redress before the court, because it would all, what the Trump administration is arguing is that if somebody sues in whatever district, that ruling from that judge only applies in that district and it wouldn't have a national application. And in an issue with something like birthright citizenship, that could create a patchwork of laws. So any signals from the court on how, I mean, Nina said that there could be, she has six,
right,
there could be a dozen different outcomes, any signals?
Well, this is part of what's distressing about this case for those of us who care about courts and the scope of their powers, set of issues that I work on a lot. And, you know, the conservatives on the court have been sort of gunning for the broad remedial powers of district courts for some time. And, they've obviously chosen this case as a vehicle to say something about it. And the thing is, you could not script a case where broad remedial orders are more justified than this one, right? For exactly the reason, Cherry, that you just mentioned.
It has to do with U.S. citizenship, the whole country.
It is a question that has to be answered the same way for everybody, right? This is not a question that's going to vary from person to person. It's a question where when a person gets a resolution of that question, they have to be able to carry it with them all around the country. And it's a question where if you grant relief that only applies in some districts or only applies to some situations, then, and this is one of the arguments the states made in this case, we have to administer programs that have to operate the same way for everybody against these legal principles. And so if the court says something...
Sorry to interrupt you, but why would the U.S. Supreme Court have an interest in doing that? It feels like a very chaotic outcome. I'm not sure. Like what is like the conservative legal theory behind we don't want lower courts to be able to issue rulings that have even temporary national impacts? I just don't get it.
Sure. I mean, this is an issue that...
It's like a federalism thing? I don't know.
So it's an issue that if you want to do a sort of purely legal realist, like why do people care about this in terms of outcomes?
Yeah.
While obviously people challenge both Democratic and Republican programs and laws and initiatives, as a general matter, I think when people are seeking relief against government laws and programs, it is often more in the direction of advancing progressive values than advancing conservative values. And so I think the calculation is that if you place restraints on the remedial powers of lower federal courts, it will more often redound to the benefit of conservative programs.
Doesn't it just slow things down, though? Or just like you could there what are 13 U.S. courts of appeal, right? Can I just file in all 13 the exact same case, find a person in each one, and
but that's more work, yeah.
I don't really get it. Other than slow it down, I don't get how it changed. Nina, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think what we really have to recognize here is that this is a problem that has confounded not just the Trump administration, but the Biden administration, and to a much lesser extent, the Obama administration. But it was not a problem until very recently. Because the courts weren't, the cases didn't come up as fast.
Yeah. Mm, yeah.
They didn't leapfrog over the appellate courts and just go from the district court and to the Supreme Court. All of this was sort of pioneered much more in the first Trump administration. And the statistics that our friend Steve Vladeck compiled are just really telling. In the 16 years of the Bush and Obama administrations, there were 8 of these appeals to the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. to 8 of these what are called shadow docket appeals, saying, come help us before your case is argued. Yeah. Just grant us a stay, stop them from doing what they're doing. And there were only 8 in 16 years. That's 1 every 2 years. And both the Bush administration and the Obama administration only got what they wanted 4 times. So now you get to the first Trump administration, there are 41 of them.
Yeah.
And they win in whole or in part, I think, in 28 of them. And now, then comes the Biden administration. They go to court asking to block lower court orders. Now it's 19 times. Okay, now we've got the second Trump administration. They've done it 19 times in 5 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you can see this is an exponential problem, and it sort of puts law on a rocket to the moon.
Yeah.
And nobody knows really whether it's got the equipment to land.
Yeah.
So everybody's actually concerned about this. We know when the Democrats were in office, there are several judges in Texas who would grant almost anything mm-hmm. that conservatives mm-hmm. came and asked them to do. And the Fifth Circuit would uphold most of them. And they all had to go to the Supreme Court on stays, where the government had to say, please don't stop mifepristone from being available, for example. And so this is not just a Republican and Democratic phenomenon. But it is a Republican, very aggressive Republican administration pushing on a conservative door that wants to open.
Yeah. And I want to just sort of, because we do have a couple more cases to talk about that are pending, but I want to pivot a little bit and talk about the shadow docket. Mm-hmm. This, we don't have tons of, well thought out opinions that come from these types of rulings, right? And it's very thin precedent for people to rely on because you don't see the rationale of the court. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson has sort of spoken out against this in her dissents and how this is being misused. Tobias, your thoughts on that and how this is sort of reshaping and could impact public's perception of the court if you have no idea why the justices ruled in a certain kind of way?
Well, one of the things that's most problematic about this so-called, and let's just say a word about what we mean by this term shadow docket,
yeah,
right?
Please explain.
So ordinarily when federal courts decide cases and do things, they give fully reasoned explanations for why they're doing what they're doing. And they're usually doing it on the basis of a factual record that's been developed. And that's true at the district court level, the trial court level. That's true when an appeal goes up to the intermediate circuit courts. And it's true at the Supreme Court. There are mechanisms for asking the Supreme Court to weigh in really quickly, the kind of rocket schedule that Nina mentioned, and not to issue a final decision in a case, but just to put things on hold.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, just the other day, the administration has been engaged in a very distressing practice of taking non-citizens whom they want to deport and engaging in rendition practices to third countries.
Yeah.
Not their home country.
Deporting them to a country they're not from.
Not the place where they came to, a place where they have no relationship. And frankly, places that seem to be chosen for the danger and harm that they are likely to encounter. Libya, South Sudan, mm-hmm. El Salvador, right? And so lower federal courts had put that on, had issued an injunction that said, you're not giving them the due process they're entitled to. And the administration said, okay, we're going to appeal that. While we're appealing it, put that injunction on hold so that we can keep on doing this during the course of the appeal. And the district court said, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not warranted. The First Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, we're not going to do that. And just the other day, with no explanation, the Supreme Court said, yeah, we'll put that on hold. We're not deciding the case.
Yeah.
The injunction is on hold while the case is on appeal, which effectively means that the administration can keep on sending people to prisons in Libya or South Sudan or wherever they've chosen and subjecting them to great harm. It's quite shocking. And so the shadow docket refers to the mechanisms that the court can use to put relief on hold, right?
Yeah.
Why are they doing it? So here's one possible explanation. This administration is doing a lot of illegal things. And in some cases, they're making arguments that Supreme Court precedent should change. But regardless, they're doing a lot of illegal things.
Yeah.
And the lower federal courts, I mean, the reason they're losing so often in federal court, it's not because the lower federal courts don't like them. It's because they're doing illegal things. The Supreme Court may know that they're going to have to rule against them in some big cases.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible that they want to balance that out with throwing them some wins
in the
short term.
And that's political issue jumped into the court. I know we only have a couple more minutes with Nina Totenberg, so I want to jump back over to you, Nina.
I'll stay.
Okay.
I'll stay.
Wait, you got to do like seven more pre-writes though, Nina.
Well, all my pre-writes are done. They're fine. They were done.
Congratulations. That must be a milestone, by the way, for you every June when you get through like the last pre-write.
I know, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly labor intensive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we live in a world where not only do we do radio, we do digital.
Yes.
And with digital, my folks, I can be at the court and they can just fill in the quotes from whoever the justice in the majority is and the justice in the dissent is. And it's up online in a matter of minutes.
That's the secret right there. But we're talking about the shadow docket a little bit, but we have some more cases outstanding. And the big one, of course, we just talked about was birthright citizenship. But is there another one or two, Nina, that sort of stand out to you that are you think will be majorly consequential?
Well, you know, there are a couple, but the one I'm very interested in, and I'm pretty sure how it's going to end up based on how the oral argument went, is this case that tests whether parents who have religious objections mm-hmm. to content in public school classes can opt their children out of any classroom when a subject comes up where they don't agree on religious reasons and don't want their children exposed to that. And the conservatives on the court seemed extremely receptive to that idea. And I didn't hear much talk about limiting it. And of course, the school officials are shaking in their boots because when they've tried to do this, they have found it's very disruptive. What do you do with the kids when they're
when they're suddenly out of class? And where do you draw the line? Okay, you don't want your six-year-old to have a book read to her that includes gay and lesbian characters. Okay, now what about when your 13-year-old is being taught the theory of evolution in a science class?
Yeah.
I mean, we've never balkanized our public schools quite that way. And it is indicative of where the court is on religion cases. You know, when I first started covering the Supreme Court many decades ago, there are two provisions in the First Amendment. One guarantees that nobody will be discriminated against. Well, everybody has the free exercise of religion, and the other bars state establishment of religion. Well, the Establishment Clause was much more powerful in those days. It's almost non-existent today. The court was tied on the question of whether there could be overtly Catholical, ecclesiastical charter schools, which are public schools. Mm-hmm. And therefore, because it was tied, there was no decision. But it tells you how far we've gone.
Yeah, we're close. Yeah.
And it sounds like you only have two pre-writes on this one, on this ruling.
Well, it's done. They were tied, and therefore there was no decision.
Just want to read a comment here from David. Some legal scholars and justices have warned that the increasing use of the shadow docket for significant rulings blurs the line between emergency relief and substantive decision making. Great comment, David, on YouTube.
Thank you.
Keep those comments coming. Studio2@whyy.org. We will be right back talking about what the High Court has done, what it is still slated to do before we turn over to the month of July. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We've been talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, its outstanding cases and decisions. Their term is wrapping up next week. And now we're going to wrap up what's ahead, then shift to the decisions that have already come down, as well as take a look at public perception of the court. And with us in studio is Tobias Wolf, Jefferson B. Fordham Professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. We also have Nina Totenberg, NPR's Legal Affairs Correspondent.
And we want to hear from you. What U.S. Supreme Court cases are you paying most attention to? Which ones do you think will be the most consequential? And do you have faith in the High Court? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat. I wanted to tie up some loose ends here, Tobias, before we move on. You mentioned earlier that you think the court is maybe throwing the administration some early wins as a political gesture, which, by the way, I don't think that's what they're supposed to do, but whatever, let's put that aside. It does feel a little bit like we're delaying the inevitable. Like, here is this very aggressive administration. The court is going to be tasked at some point with checking them, but they maybe don't want to do it right away, or they want to wait a little longer. Is that the dynamic right now? And if so, like, what are the consequences of that for American democracy?
Well, I mean, I will say there's certainly a legitimate role for the court to play in pacing the way in which it engages with issues and avoiding having to issue major consequential rulings if they turn out not to be necessary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if this is part of what underlies the court's thinking in the way that it's been proceeding for the last 5 months, but they may believe that some of the more disruptive actions and policies that this regime has been undertaking may play themselves out before the Supreme Court is put in the position of issuing a major ruling on their constitutionality. And perhaps that's part of their reasoning in lifting or staying some of these injunctions, that some of these policies may just kind of, you know, play themselves out before they actually have to go to the Supreme Court. I don't know. But
it's also a possibility they're scared or something. They don't want a constitutional crisis.
So this is
they
the
don't
other,
want a showdown.
This is the other question, right, is if they find themselves having – I mean, so for example, the issue of courts holding the administration in contempt if they violate judicial orders – this is an issue that clearly the Supreme Court doesn't want to have to engage with if they can avoid it. And so the lower federal courts have been extremely forbearant with this administration, which has been just flouting the authority of courts in quite distressing and offensive ways, if you'll allow me to say that. And they, you know, if this were any other litigant, we would already be seeing criminal contempt prosecutions. They've been giving them every opportunity to cure their contempt and otherwise avoid, and we don't yet see a criminal contempt prosecution. I think the court recognizes the prospect, the possibility of having to assert the authority of the judiciary against an executive that is sort of directly claiming the ability not to be bound by the orders of courts. And there are certainly people in this White House who seem to be trying to push in that direction. And I do think that they're trying to avoid that if they can.
And to me, that raises the question of confidence in the court. I mean, confidence in the Supreme Court has steadily declined over the decades, with 47% of Americans viewing the court favorably and 51% viewing them unfavorably. And I just sort of wonder, and Nina, you can jump in here, if, you know, there's this hesitancy there because, you know, with people like trusting the court less, they don't want to have this direct showdown with the executive. Any thoughts on that and what you've seen and what you've been hearing from the court?
Well, you know, the easy way to avoid having a direct showdown is to not intervene, to not grant the administration's request to pause lower court actions, at least in a bunch of cases. I mean, I am somewhat chastened a little bit by a couple of things. Number one was the court's immunity decision last term, which gave Trump not only what he wanted, but more than his own lawyers had asked for. So that he, quite rightly now, is somewhat emboldened about what kind of powers he can exercise. And secondly, you see in some cases that the court is not loath to signal what its opinion is when it wants to. So it says you can, it does not interfere with the firing of presidential appointees at high levels. In this case, it was somebody on the NLRB board and somebody on the and the chair of the Merit System Protections Board. So they can be they allow them to be fired at will on an interim basis, I grant you, because they haven't finally decided it. But they actually wrote something, and they rebutted Justice Kagan's dissent by saying, "Oh well, the Federal Reserve would be different. We wouldn't do this to the allow the president to fire Federal Reserve members." Well, that, you know, where does that come from?
Yeah,
that's not what courts normally do when they grant a stay or don't grant a stay. It's a little bizarre right now. Yeah. I think the president of the United States has made the Supreme Court a little bizarre, and they're all exhausted. Let's also say that. They're exhausted.
And,
it's been
going
on for years. It's time for them to leave town. And they want to get out of Dodge.
That case that Nina just mentioned is the most extraordinary, oh, by the way, that the court has done, right? We're going to They ignored their own precedent from 100 years ago that said presidents don't have an unlimited ability to fire executive appointees. They put on hold a ruling of the lower federal courts that quite responsibly applied those precedents and said, no, 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 you can fire these executive appointees on an interim basis. And around the same time, Mr. Trump had been sounding off about how maybe he would fire the chair of the Federal Reserve. And so they just throw in this, oh, by the way, and say, but you can't do this, right? We're going to make constitutional law in this opinion responding to a dissent from our order and basically tell the administration, here's how far you can go in engaging in these disruptive, law-violating, under current standards actions. But if you do this thing, which is really going to upset the markets and is really going to upset the financial sector, we're going to step in. That's I mean, obviously, to your point, that's not how the court is supposed to be operating.
Can I we mentioned earlier this case, Mahmoud v. Taylor, which had to do with a group of parents, Montgomery County, Maryland, wanting to opt their kids out of certain lessons involving LGBTQ themes and characters. And then there was also already a decision in a case involving a Tennessee law that banned minors from using hormones and puberty blockers. The court upheld that law. And so I want to use that as a setup for a caller we have here. This is Sue from Fairmount, who's really having trouble squaring those two things, especially because we do believe the parents will prevail in this case out of Montgomery County, Maryland. So Sue, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment for our experts?
Well, my comment is you referred to those two cases, which to me are contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
So the Supreme Court says in some cases, oh, the parents cannot decide what kind of medical treatment their children are going to receive, their minor children are going to receive. Yet on the other hand, they're going to allow parents to decide, I don't want my children to learn about X, Y, and Z, therefore it appears the Supreme Court is going to allow them to somehow withdraw their children from that particular assignment. And I don't understand how they can, they're talking out of both sides of their mouth.
Mm. All right. So can you weigh in on that, Tobias or Nina, either one? I mean, is this
conscious?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
This is a little nitpicky, but the question they decided in the Tennessee case was whether the state could ban procedures entirely for trans, for minors. But they didn't decide, they could have, but they didn't. The second question that the court had been asked to decide and it didn't take it on was, do parents have the right to decide? And at least in the sense of kids who are already on certain treatments, not discontinuing them. But I don't know that question will ever get to the court. They had the opportunity to split the difference, and they didn't. Yeah, what do you think, Tobias?
Yeah, Tobias, weigh in on that.
So the Scrimeti decision, this is the Tennessee case. I agree with Nina that the parental choice, parental autonomy issue is not likely to get to the court because it's a tough claim to make, because it's one thing to say parents have a right to choose which among several treatments that are approved and available they, in consultation with their doctors, will get for their kids, right? It's a very different thing to say that parents have a right to choose what treatments should be available in the first place, that they should be able to exercise independent medical judgment over what the state is saying. Now, states like Tennessee that are banning access to gender-affirming care for young trans kids are acting, in my view, I work on this issue, so I should indicate that I'm not an unbiased observer here, but they're acting against the best interests of these kids and against the overwhelming weight of responsible medical evidence here. But as a constitutional matter, that's a very different thing, right? But it highlights the point that Nina made before the break about the potential disruptive quality of this opt-out in schools.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really the case that the Supreme Court is going to say that any parent who has a religious objection to their kids studying any subject can opt their kids out of that subject and disrupt the normal functioning of the school day? I take it that means that parents are just going to have a veto on the curriculum, because schools are not going to be able to actually do this on a daily basis. They're just going to take stuff out of the curriculum altogether.
Yeah, because it would just be, because functionally it would be too disruptive.
I think that's right. Yeah. And that's very distressing. That's very distressing.
And we only have a couple more minutes before the show is over. And I wanted to just quickly talk about this redistricting case, because it could have major political implications, and actually talk about impact the you know, makeup of Congress. In this case, the Louisiana legislature redrew its congressional map to create a second majority black district out of six districts in the state. And the Supreme Court is being asked to decide whether the map violates the Constitution. How big of a ripple effect could this have? And any indication, quickly, what you think the court would rule? And I want to get Nina and both you, Tobias, to weigh in, and if you could do that briefly.
So this is the Supreme Court has been making it tougher and tougher to enforce the provisions of the Voting Rights Act and to enforce the principle that race should not be used to dilute the political and voting power of non-white Americans. And both in identifying when racial gerrymandering is that's improper is happening, and then in defining the scope of remedies that are available. And one of the issues in – so this is a case in which a federal district court found that having only one of the six Louisiana districts being one where black voters can exercise political power, despite being a third of the population, that violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And so the question is, how do you craft a remedy? And essentially what the Supreme Court is doing in this case, in the oral arguments in this case, they're saying, well, if you're taking race into account too much in crafting a remedy, that may be an independent problem, which is a kind of nutty thing to say in a case where the problem is that Louisiana has deprived black voters of voting power by crafting districts mm-hmm. that don't allow them to elect representatives.
Yeah. And we only have less than a minute, Nina. Any thoughts on how or any signals on how the court will rule?
I think, you know, up until now, the court, very narrow court, 5-4, had upheld the vote dilution principle in a case from Alabama. Now we have a case from Louisiana. And what's interesting about it is, how do you tell the difference between what is a racial gerrymander and what is a political gerrymander? And here, the state of Louisiana says very clearly, yeah, it's a gerrymander, but we had to do it because we had to create it. You told us basically we had to create a second district, and we couldn't, we had to protect the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader of the House, who are from Louisiana. So it looks ugly, but but it's not a racial gerrymander. Right. And the court seemed to have a hard time swallowing
for
that.
Sure.
So we'll see what happens.
Well, let me leave on this comment from Caramelizing, who says, Nina Totenberg, exclamation point,
the boss.
You supplanted Bruce Springsteen, Nina. Thanks for being with us today. That's Nina Totenberg.
Thank you for having
NPR's me. Legal Affairs Correspondent. And thank you so much to Tobias Wolf, Jefferson B. Fordham Professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. Really appreciate your time as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry we couldn't get to Guy from Hamilton Township, New Jersey. You were on the line. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes, Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calique, and our executive producer, Kevin McCrory.